At age 60, Hope is tired of working, and she's hoping to retire in 2 to 3 years. Should she factor home equity into her retirement spending plan with a reverse mortgage? Which mortgage option for a Houston dream home is best for Nisa in San Jose's early retirement goals? That's today on Your Money, Your Wealth podcast number 476. Plus, Wayne in Phoenix needs to know how the Section 121 tax exclusion works on a vacation home. And Jack and Jill in the UAE have questions about tax gain harvesting and the foreign earned income exclusion. Finally, are Joe and Big Al off their strategy game? A Spotify listener takes the fellas to task about the Affordable Care Act subsidy discussed in episode 472 and challenges their spitball for Duke and Daisy's retirement spending plan in episode 475. But first, what is private credit and where does it fit in your investment portfolio? I'm producer Andy Last, and here are the hosts of Your Money, Your Wealth, Joy Anderson, CFP, and Big Al Clopine, CPA.
We got Janine from La Jolla, California. Joe, Al, Andy, love the show. I searched Apple Podcasts for Roth conversion, and I was trying to learn more about them. So we popped up, Al.
Apparently. Apparently we talk about it once or twice. A show.
And there it was. YMYW. Now I'm hooked. All right. I listen while chauffeuring around my dog. Mutt named Jack in a 2022 Tesla Model Y. Don't drink often, but when I go out, I ask for a Foxy
Cleopatra.
Oh, what the hell's that?
Well, it says sparkling wine, apple cider, cinnamon, and bitters.
Never had that?
Never.
Sounds like it's not up your alley, right?
I never had that either myself.
Sparkling wine, apple cider, little cinnamon, and bitters. Sparkling wine. What is that? Is that white?
That like champagne?
Yeah. And champagne?
I think it's only allowed to be called champagne if it's actually from that region of France. So otherwise, it's sparkling wine.
Got it.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Right. Now for my question, which actually isn't about Roth conversions. In the last couple of years, I heard a lot about using private credit to diversify an investment portfolio, but it's usually from people who are, of course, selling it. What do you guys know about it? Thanks for your insight and keep up the great work. Private credit. Wow. Sophistication here.
Yeah, we are. We're going to go deep down into this now.
It is very popular over the last couple of years. A couple of reasons why. Remember Silicon Valley Bank, Big Al?
Yes.
So let's go back a couple of years. So what happens? Inflation goes up. The Fed tries to fight it.
Yeah.
What do they do?
They raise interest rates.
Interest rates, right? So interest rates go. And they go pretty high and they go pretty quickly.
They hurt some banks. They got a little bit overextended.
Yeah, they blew up some banks. And then this is prior, if we even go back further with the credit crisis, there's some laws that came into play to restrict and have maybe a little bit more oversight on the larger banks.
Right. On lending.
Yes. And so then you got these smaller regional banks that blew up. And it's like, well, you know, these small businesses need capital. So private equity, we know a little bit about private equity.
We do.
You know, they invest in smaller companies, a little bit more risky companies.
Yeah, they're looking for a higher return, but there's more risk.
Yeah. And they go in and they take a company, a small company like ours, and they help with maybe better executive management. They got to look at balance sheet finances, and they brush it up and try to, you know, get the company to perform a little bit better than they would on their own.
Right.
And so private equity has been around for quite some time. And so private credit now is kind of, is private equity's, what, twin brother?
Yeah, twin brother or sister.
Yeah.
Or whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
And so private credit now is coming to the forefront by getting in and offering loans instead of purchasing some of that. It's just like there's equity or stocks versus bonds or loans.
Yeah. So it's okay. So yeah, private equity, more like a stock, private credit, more like a bond or a loan.
Correct. And so the yields are pretty good because it's a loan, but it doesn't trade.
No,
it's not a bond.
They're generally illiquid.
Very much so.
So you make a loan and you wait for it to get paid off.
Sure.
You may get interest payments or maybe even some principal interest. A lot of them, I think, are interest only.
So there's high yields here. So you want to be very careful and you want to understand what you're getting into. This is a private market. This is not public markets. Public markets, you know, they're a lot more transparent than private markets.
Yeah. And public markets are a lot more regulated.
Exactly. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying they're good or bad. I think it's a diversifier. Sure. It's a different way to, extract yield for the overall portfolio. If you know what you're doing and you know how to do due diligence, or you're working with a professional that's really good at this stuff, you know, then might take a look at it.
Yeah.
I would say for the average investor, I don't know if they have enough time or resources to dive in and look out at all these notes to see which one may default or may not, or what's legit, because they're all small businesses that they're right. lending this money to, that it's not an Apple corporate
right.
loan.
Right. right. And there's a lot of money flowing into this space right now. So it's getting a lot of press, and whether that's good or bad, I'm not even going to say either. I would say this, though. I do not have any money in private credit. Do you?
Not yet.
Yeah. So there you go.
It's crazy. I mean, we get calls and emails, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 a week, it seems like, from some of these companies. But yeah, it's pretty popular right now. So what does that mean? Is that... It's at a high?
It's just, in general, higher returns, higher risk. I mean, that's kind of what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And illiquidity, which is okay for some, and others, it's like, well, no, I can't be without my money for 5 years or 10 years or whatever the loan is.
There's an illiquid premium for this.
Of course.
And so when you look at it, like, these investments are normally for high net worth individuals that have a lot more capital, where they could have 10, 15% of their capital tied up for 5 years, where they don't necessarily need the liquidity.
Yeah. I think in the past, Joe, you're absolutely right. Like pension funds and
endowments
kind of dabbled in this kind of thing. Now it's kind of becoming more common to everyday investors.
Right. And because the access now is crazy, where you needed millions and millions to get into some of these investments.
Right.
Now they're fund of funds, there's pooled funds, there's different platforms where the average investor now can have access to, you know, unique exotic type investments. Not saying private credit is all that unique and exotic, but you're right, Alan. I think you hit it on the head, is that there's higher risk and you will receive a higher expected return.
Right.
But it's almost like equity-like returns with equity-like risk. Why don't you just go with equities? You know, it is a diversifier, and you could get potentially lucky depending on the bundle of notes that you get into.
Right.
But have you ever seen The Big Short?
Yes.
So what was his name? Burry was reading like every single prospectus of thousands and hundreds of thousands of, I mean, if you have a brain like that guy, then
go for it,
because you could definitely find alpha. And what alpha is that you can receive a higher expected return with probably less risk. But
if you know what you're doing,
if you have to know what you do.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So, all right, that's a cool question. We got Hope writes in. Hi, all, love the show. Learn a lot from the spitballs and the variety scenarios you cover, since I know you like limericks. Here's an amateur or immature one for you.
Kim?
Limericks.
It's the new hotness.
It's hot. There once was a podcast on money with Joe, Big Al, and Andy. Quite funny. They offered spitballs to folks and told mostly good jokes. But the best part was their loving camaraderie.
Wow.
Camaraderie.
Yeah.
So that's probably going to be a word that I blew up.
That's it. Hope that's very nice.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah. Very, very pleasant.
It was. Just rolled out the tongue.
It did.
Until the last word. On to my topic, which is one I haven't heard you address. Reverse mortgages. Here's my situation. I'm divorced. I'm age 60 with a domestic partner in a legal agreement that outlines our separate assets. We share all expenses. I have $1.4 million in pre-tax accounts. I earn about $200,000 to $220,000 a year and put about $30,000 away in my 401k. I have approximately $2 million in home equity with a $230,000 mortgage with 2.65% interest, which will be paid off in the next 12 years. We enjoy traveling, and our current expenses are approximately $150,000 a year, which I pay $75,000. I recently paid off a HELOC and shed a husband.
A double. Got a double.
A little double banger. So I don't currently have much cash. Now my goal is to build up my savings starting in 2024. I should be able to put $40,000 away for each year that I continue to work. Social Security benefits, about 25,000 at 62, 40,000 at 67, or 50 at 72. Don't wait till 72.
Yeah, at 70 is the last
70.
Date.
70 is where...
I think she meant 70.
All right. I would like to work two or three more years. I'm tired, you guys.
You can just hear her personality. It's great.
Running the calculation, I've learned from listening to your show. I believe I'm close. When I retire, I'll work with my accountant to determine when to draw on Social Security versus to pull from my pre-tax retirement accounts. My partner is financially stable and has a solid retirement plan, so I don't need to include him in financial scenarios. Here's my question. What do you think about factoring in home equity as a bucket of money that I can use in my later years? If I live that long and if I need it, I live in a desirable area where my house should continue to increase in value. I know reverse mortgages generally have high fees and allow one to draw only a percentage of the home value. But could it still provide a kind of financial insurance plan, which would allow me to stay in my house longer versus selling it outright? Does a reverse mortgage ever make sense? I drive a 10-year-old BMW SUV. We enjoy all kinds of cocktails, except for rum. Yeah, me too. Sorry.
Sorry, Al. I do like rum.
Yeah, I appreciate the spitball signed Hope, as in hoping to retire soon. Emoji.
Yeah.
Emoji. All right. Reverse mortgage. Yeah. Okay. So it's been a while since we've talked about
mortgages. Right.
There's something that's called a HECM. It's a home equity conversion mortgage. And we had Wade Fowler, remember?
Yep.
All right.
That was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago.
He's like the expert on reverse mortgages, but Joe knows him for his voice.
He's an expert in all things financial planning. The guy is a genius.
He could not get through a sentence without you cracking up.
I love the guy.
I know. He's bright. Brilliant. He's really smart. But he does have a different voice.
He's funny.
Yep.
And so he wrote a book about using the home equity, and it's called a HECM. Again, it's called a home equity conversion mortgage. And basically, it's a line of credit that you could potentially tap into. And so what some financial planners use home equity for is sequence of return risk. So you have a portfolio that you're drawing from, and then the market tanks, and you don't want to sell any of the securities. Like 2022, when both stocks and bonds went down, it was pretty hard for people to sell something if they didn't have enough cash at a loss.
Right.
Because usually, all right, if stocks go down, bonds at least will hold true.
Right.
But not last year.
Yeah.
Or 22.
Yeah, they all went down, didn't they?
So you could tap into this line of credit that you don't necessarily ever have to pay back. So for some people, it's like, all right, well, here, I don't necessarily want to leave a long-lasting legacy. Might as well tap into the home. Yeah, there's fees and there's expense, just like with anything else. But if you open up a line of credit, let's say you have a line of credit of X dollars, that line of credit continues to grow for you. So what some experts say in this field, and trust me, I am not an expert in reverse mortgages or a mortgage broker or sell mortgages, but I think you might want to look into it. If this is a contingency plan, because she's got a ton of equity there, you might want to at least open it. It doesn't cost you a few bucks to open it, but then... You know, if you ever want to draw on it, you can have access to cash and you don't necessarily have to pay it back. So I don't know. I think it's worth a peek.
Yeah, I think it's worth a look too, because there's a lot of home equity. You don't necessarily need to use it. Now, of course, your home is always a fallback asset. Like, let's say you need to go to a retirement home. You can always sell your home and use the money that way. You don't necessarily need a reverse mortgage. In fact, if you had a reverse mortgage and it's no longer your principal residence, you have to sell the property at that point because you have to live in the home. You have to be 62 years of age. And you got to live in the home. Some other rules were kind of oversimplifying, but not a bad idea to look at. I did some quick numbers. I think you're right. I think you're pretty close. You may not need it, but it's a nice fallback.
Learn more about how to use a reverse mortgage to secure your retirement from the expert himself, Dr. Wade Fowle, way back on Your Money, Your Wealth podcast, episode 117. I've linked to it in the podcast show notes to make it easy for you. And from various mortgage options to the 7 benefits of downsizing and some creative alternatives, Joe and Big Al discuss even more ways your home can create retirement income new this week on YMYW TV. Watch that in the podcast show notes as well, and download the Retirement Readiness Guide. Just click the link in the description of today's episode in your favorite podcast app to get there. Now let's stick with the mortgage topic for just a bit longer.
We got NISA. Is that your
Sounds good to me. Old
employee?
Yeah, but that's same name.
Yeah.
Probably a different person because the NISA I know lives in La Mesa.
Oh, San Jose, California. We go, hi, Andy, Joe, Big Al, love the podcast. Hilarious, fun, and very informative to listen. Plus, really great dynamic among the three of you. The best I've seen.
Wow.
You see it?
It's that camaraderie.
How do you see a podcast? Is this on YouTube or somewhere? I don't see any cameras.
She can imagine.
Got it. And a fantastic, Andy must have wrote this.
Andy, that's got to be the answer, right?
It is. Andy is fantastic at producing the show and having two knowledgeable podcasters well-behaved through the show. A little smiley face there.
Does that apply that we're not well-behaved with that,
guess,
Andy?
No,
I think so.
Andy keeps us
in
check.
Right.
All right. My townhouse is currently worth $1.2 million, $1.4 per my agent. I paid over $200,000 in principal over the past 4 years, and there is $420,000 mortgage left. My goal is to retire next year at the age of 60 or early 61. I'd like to keep the current home while building a $600,000 dream home in Houston, Texas at the age of 62 or 63, where I'll spend over 6 months a year. No plan to rent the California home. Is taking a home equity loan or HELOC or a reverse mortgage after the age 62 for a down payment a good idea? For HELOC, should I apply while I'm still being employed? All right. I manage my own 401k account for the past 10 years, total $1.3 million, among which $160 is after tax, and I plan on doing a mega backdoor conversion in 2025 at 22.95 return in 2023 is the norm, except for 2022 that had a negative
return.
What is she talking about? Like, she's so good at her 401k. She got a 22.95% rate of return in 2023.
And that's the norm, except for in 2022.
No, that's the norm.
I think that's what she's saying. This is great. This is a great 401k.
So NISA gets an average rate of return with her investing prowess of 23% per year.
22.95 to be more precise.
But 23 or 22 was...
That was a bad year. Negative year.
Off year.
We won't talk about that then.
Yeah. Negative XX percent. She didn't want to put in the numbers.
I see.
Double X.
Right.
All righty. I have $420,000 in a brokerage bank high yield I-bond account, averaging 5 to 8% annual returns. A separate $190,000 IRA managed by an advisor that I inherited from a deceased ex-spouse 10 years ago, averages 8% return. It's not as good as the 23% that she's got.
No, but still pretty good.
I plan to use these funds to pay for Roth conversion taxes and the annual $100,000 living expenses till I have to draw from my converted Roth account. The $100,000 expense includes mortgage, property tax, annual charitable giving in to a fund, a restricted endowment fund I established helping adult children in some of my hobbies. All right.
Okay, cool. Very good.
Also, I have $40,000 in RSUs that will be vested in the next 3 years, depending on when I retire. I may have another $20,000 worth of RSUs in 2025. My significant quantities of stock options, unfortunately, are all underwater, and I don't ever foresee an increase in values. Okay. I plan to take Social Security benefits at 70, and non-COLA adjusted pension is what, $550 a month at age 65. Goals to live to 100 years old.
Good. All right. Centurion.
Since I started planning for early retirement 2 weeks ago.
That's it. Yeah. Something happened at the job. I don't like this anymore.
Something upset her.
I'm going to write the guys. I'm out of here. How's this look?
Yeah, buddy. I have run various scenarios and simulations using spreadsheets I built and purchased online. It seems that they all tell me that an early retirement is feasible, but I'd like to hear your professional opinions. I currently drive a 2017 Subaru Outback 2.51 Premium. Donated my VW convertible years ago and maybe get a Mercedes when I have some free cash. Oh, I'm a wine drinker mostly.
Musket.
Yeah. Is my favorite. I will enjoy the best lemon drop From a local steakhouse or margarita for a change. All right. Thanks for taking my question. Hopefully I can hear my case on the air soon. All right. Well, here, you made the big time. You're on the air. All righty. $100,000 a year. Well, if she keeps on getting 23%, she's good.
Well, to be fair, 2022 was not a good year, and 2023 was a recovery year. So I think if you average the two, that would probably be a little bit closer to normal.
Sure. All right. So 1.3. One,
so he's got
4.5.
He's got 2 million.
2 million.
Yep.
Okay. She wants 4 times 2 is 8 plus Social Security plus pension. Yeah, I think she's good. The issue is she doesn't want to sell the San Jose house, and she wants to buy her dream house in Houston, Texas for $600,000.
Right. Right. Which basically, and she doesn't have the cash to do it, so she's going to have to borrow it one way or another. So you're adding, and I agree, I think the numbers look all right as is, but adding more debt as you do in early retirement, that could make it a little trickier.
So she's got $400,000 of debt today, $600,000. She wants, she probably puts at least, what, 20% down.
I know, but she doesn't have any savings. So she's going to have to borrow everything, whether it's a HELOC from her current. So she's going to end up with $600,000 more of debt.
I thought she had a brokerage account $420,000. Yeah, I have $420,000 in a brokerage bank high yield fund.
I missed that. Yep. Yeah. Okay.
So
yep.
All right. So then put $100,000 down at least, right?
Yeah, yeah.
A couple hundred grand.
Yep.
So then you carry a $400,000 note.
Sure.
With today's interest rates.
Yeah, that's the tricky part.
Right. Well, you can always refinance at some point, but then she's not going to be employed.
Right. Which makes it harder.
Which makes it.
Because you need income to be able to qualify for loans.
Yeah, or you can do an asset-based loan, but so that's another $30,000 roughly of expenses on top of the $100,000.
Yeah.
So now let's call it $130,000. You have $2 million.
Yeah, and you're going to use, what'd you say, a couple million? I mean, a couple hundred thousand for the home.
Mm-hmm.
So you got 1.8. You need about 100.
130.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's tight.
Tight.
It's tight. It's. With Social Security, I think she's fine, but she's retiring at 60, 61. So it's a little tight. It's,
yep.
I'm not saying not to do it. I'm just saying you're kind of on the edge.
Well, what happens when you buy your dream home?
Well, then you improve it. You add furniture. Oh, I want a better patio.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm thinking Houston. I want a pool for the summer.
Yes,
sir. It gets a little warm there.
Yeah. Oh, I want some misters.
Well, that too.
It's... Yeah, because next thing you know, that $600,000, yeah, you got the house, but then you got all the other stuff that goes along with it.
Yeah, right.
And then all of a sudden, you just see that bank account kind of keep dipping.
You know, this is just me, based upon what little I know. If this were me and I really want to be in Houston,
I would sell San Jose and move to Houston.
I'd sell it, or I would downsize, just get a little condo so I could revisit there with my friends, and maybe I got family out there. But yeah, I don't. You know, if you want to be in Houston, be in Houston.
But she's, I know what she's saying. She's like, have you ever been to Houston in the summer?
Just... She wants to get, and I get that. So you got a little condo in San Jose that costs half the price of her current one. That's what I would think about doing.
Yeah. I almost died in Houston last summer.
Did you?
Yeah. Heat? Playing golf.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
We're driving to the golf course and on the radio, they're saying, please stay indoors. And it's like, eep, eep, eep.
The alert on your phone.
Right. Please stay in. It's an emergency heat alert.
Yeah, yeah.
So I get it.
Or the other thing, too, is if you don't necessarily need a place in San Jose, but you just want to get out for the summer, just get an Airbnb. You know, do a month in San Jose, do a month in Italy, do a month in Hawaii. Have fun. Wow. How about that?
That's the Big Al way of living.
That's Big Al.
That's my approach.
All right. Well, there you go. Good luck with that. No, it would work for another 5 years if you're going to take the Big Al plan. We got Wayne from Phoenix, Arizona. Of a very fortunate problem. Oh, no, a vacation condo in San Diego.
Yeah. Right.
Purchased it in 2008. Never used it as a rental. My plan was to someday move into it and make it my primary residence for more than 2 years, sell it and exclude it from the gain in taxes. I've seen this strategy on several websites. But when I thoroughly read the IRS publication 523, I don't think it's valid. 523 says that any use of the property as a vacation home after 2008 is not excludable. Then it sends you to a worksheet, which looks like you can only exclude gain from the portion of time it was your primary residence. I'd love your input on this. I drive a Zamboni.
he likes ice, huh?
Yeah. And I love any beer from all the awesome breweries in San Diego.
Oh.
Okay. Well, so he's right.
Yeah, he's right. So, Wayne, you're talking about the
121.
Right, 121 exclusion, which basically states this. If you have your primary residence and you live in it 2 out of the last 5 years, you can exclude up to $250,000 of gain or $500,000 if you're married. So that is correct. And that was the rule for pretty much all properties, even rentals, until 2008. So in 2008, now they make you look at how many years were principal residence and how many years were not principal residence. So vacation, property, rental, doesn't matter. They all lopped into that category. So let's just say you move in and a couple years, I'm just, to make it easy math, I'm going to say you sell it in 2028. So that you owned it for 20 years. You lived in it for 2. It was a vacation rental for 18. Okay, so 2/18 of the gain is potentially excludable, right? Or 1/9, right? So let's
just, or 11%.
11%. 11% of the gain could be excludable up to a max of $250,000, $500,000. That's how this rule works. You will get some benefit, but do you really want to do that? Do you want to move into a vacation rental on someplace you maybe not want to live for 2 years just to save 11%? You know, what? It's up to you, right? But I probably wouldn't.
Yeah. I wish we had better news there.
Yeah. Yeah. And when they first came up with this rule, since it was a new rule, all the stuff before 2008 was considered qualifying, like it was residence because it was a new rule. So you could get away with it for a few years. But now there's so many years have passed, it's hard to get much benefit.
All right. Good luck, Wayne.
If you missed our most recent tax planning webinar, you can watch it on demand in the podcast show notes. To get educated on the limits, features, tax treatment, and new rules for your retirement accounts, like your 401k, traditional and Roth IRA, your self-employed solo 401k, and your SEP IRA, you'll find out how to maximize the tax benefits of a Roth conversion. You'll learn more ins and outs on the 5-year rules for Roth accounts and the 4 times you don't want to convert to Roth. Plus, find out how leveraging strategies like the backdoor Roth, tax loss harvesting, and tax gain harvesting can lower your tax bill as much as possible. Click the link in the description of today's episode to go to the show notes and watch the webinar on what you need to know before filing your taxes in 2024, and to download the 2024 tax planning guide. Speaking of tax gain harvesting, let's get a bit deeper into that strategy now.
Answering some money questions, going through the stack here. Slowly but surely, we're making some headway.
We're on page 3 out of 28.
Okay.
Don't tell us that, Eddie.
I'm sorry.
We get discouraged.
Yeah. She's like, well,
we've done 11%.
Hey, we've had 45 pages before, so we're like cranking.
Cranking through it. She's like, all right. You want to do this until like 9 p.m. tonight? And it's like, yeah, I'd love to. All right. Where are we? Jack and Jill ran up the hill?
To the United Arab Emirates.
Ooh, okay. Interesting. Hey, Big Al, Joan, Andy. Huh, huge, huge fan of the show.
Or hug.
Yeah, I thought it said hug there for a second. A huge fan of the show. Even though I only started listening 6 months ago, the balance of the information with humor and honest feedback, especially poking fun at callers, is spot on. It puts you guys above the rest when it comes to financial podcasts.
Right on.
Oh, poking fun. You don't do that.
That's all you do, Joe.
That's not. Some people just need to be
poked.
Not even poked. They need to have an honest conversation.
They need a little wake-up call.
Yeah, it's like, come on. I usually listen while I'm in the gym. Yeah, he's getting jacked. That's why he's called Jack.
Right.
And the only complaint I have is waiting a week for a new episode. Any chance of increasing this?
Nope. See, that's why you need to be here till 9 o'clock.
Nope.
I don't see that happening either, Jack.
About us, my wife and I are in our mid-30s. I'm Midwest born and raised, now working in the Middle East, UAE, pushing 10 years. Yay, no taxes, no kids, pets, or mortgage at this time, so very minimal expenses. Wow.
Cool.
My wife, who's not American, it doesn't have to deal with all these silly tax concerns, live abroad, drives a 2016 Toyota Harris hatchback.
Yaris.
Ooh, thank you. And I'm close enough to work where I can walk. Our drink of choice is any craft beer, IPAs and stouts in particular. A little red wine. What about the muscat?
I'm thinking I think I might want to IPA tonight.
Ooh,
sounds good.
Okay. I have a question regarding foreign earned income exclusion.
Oh boy.
Yeah, big ow. Things get better.
I'm starting to sweat here.
Focus here.
I better pay attention now.
Well, I can't contribute to any IRAs. I've been contributing about 65% of my monthly income into my brokerage account for a good portion of my time here, buying low cost ETFs. This guy's probably loaded.
Yeah.
My understanding is that capital gains rate is 0% if you don't have any taxable earned income, given that my income isn't taxed and I'm slightly below the threshold. Could I be harvesting the long-term capital gains in repurchasing the same position again, increasing my principal, and repeat this every 365 days while living abroad to reduce future capital gains? Or does this sit on top of the foreign fee?
Foreign income exclusion.
I know, but is there like, what's the acronym? What do you say? Is it FEIE or?
You just say the letters.
It's
FEIE.
Is that FEIFE?
FEIFE.
FEIEIO.
FEIEIO. Alrighty.
FEIE.
So, all right, the income exclusion.
Yeah.
It would be taxed at that income rate. Anything else I'm missing or should be considering while I have these years abroad to maximize my investment opportunity? Thanks in advance for your spitball and keep up the great content. Jack and Jill, not a real name. Oh, yeah.
Wouldn't it be crazy if it was? We literally are Jack and Jill.
He's getting jacked, though.
I was going with Jack and Jill. I'm a little disappointed.
All right. So what Jack is talking about is tax gain harvesting.
Yeah.
So there's two questions here. So tax gain harvesting, you don't have to do that every 365 days. Tax loss harvesting you do, because there's a wash sale rule. But let's say you buy a stock and the stock goes up. You buy it for a dollar and now it's worth $10. So you could do nothing. And then the stock grows to $20. And then you sell it, you got a gain of $1 to $20, right?
Right.
A $19 gain.
Sure.
Tax gain harvesting works like, okay, well, now the stock is $10. He could sell that stock. Because he's in such a low tax bracket, there is no capital gains tax up to the 12% ordinary income tax bracket, which taxable income is roughly $80,000.
Yeah, it's actually for a married couple about $94,000.
Okay, $95,000. That's what I said.
You're in the vicinity.
I was pretty close. I was in the time zone. So he's like, all right, well, here, I have all this money. He's saving 65% of his income into a brokerage account.
Yeah.
He's probably had some good gains over the years.
Yep.
And so it's like, all right, should I sell and then buy him back? Because it's increasing his basis. So in later years, when he moves back to the States where he has higher income, he's basically kind of reducing that cost basis so the gain isn't large enough where he's controlling some of the taxes long term. So I think that is a fantastic strategy, but where his question falls is that, all right, well, because I don't really pay any tax and I got this foreign income earned credit exclusion, how does all of this stuff work? How do we mix the bag?
Great question. Well, I'll start with foreign earned income exclusion. I'll try to keep this super simple, which basically means if you have a certain foreign income, like a salary, for example, you can exclude a certain dollar amount.
Is it a couple hundred thousand?
It's over 100. I don't know.
60?
No, I think it's less than that, okay. But it's over 100.
I'm just throwing out words.
Yeah.
It's numbers.
It's like, I don't know, 110, 120. You can exclude up to that amount for salary. Okay. So you record your salary on the tax return and then you exclude it under adjustments to gross income. So it's not part of your adjusted gross income. It's not part of your taxable income. It does not affect your capital gains rate. So let's start there.
Okay.
That was really his first question. Now, the second part of this is assuming that he's in the 12% bracket, which he's implying, or even 10% bracket, because he doesn't have any other income or very little income.
Sure.
Right. So if you're single, that 12% bracket goes up to 47,000. For married, we'll round it to 95,000. Why is that important? It's because that's the bracket where capital gains, long-term capital gain rate is zero, taxed at zero. Okay, so that's a good idea. If you've got stock, you can sell it at a gain, pay no tax, buy it right back, and have a higher tax basis. So when you finally sell it for good, you've got a lower gain. So that does work. But there's one major caveat that not everyone understands. Once you hit $95,000 of taxable income, if you have any more gain than that, it's taxed at 15%. Some people think that if they're in the 12%, they could sell $1 million again, it'd be fine. No, your taxable income has to be below $95,000 as a married couple to get that 0% capital gains rate.
So let's say his taxable income is $20,000.
Yeah.
So he's got up to $95,000 to stay in the 0% rate.
That's right. And he's got a $30,000 standard deduction in round numbers, right? So if that's the case, he could sell a little over $100,000 of gain in stock, presuming he had no other income.
Right. If his wife doesn't have income,
I mean, right. Whatever it may be, but you just have to make sure your taxable income is below, for a married couple, 95, for single, about half of that. Now, if you go over, it's not the end of the world. So you're a couple thousand dollars over. So that $2,000 will be taxed at a 15% capital gain rate. It's not the whole thing, right? So just be aware of that. You're trying to keep it at or below that 12% bracket.
Yeah, it doesn't, the 366 plus days, that doesn't mean anything for tax gain harvesting. If you're tax lost harvesting and getting the tax benefit, that's if you sell a stock at a loss. You can't necessarily buy that stock back because then there's a wash sale rule.
That's right. And that's actually 30 days. He said 365.
Well, no, I'm just reading what he says. Every 366 plus days. I'm like, well, why? I don't even know what that means.
No, I don't either. Here's what he means, because you have to hold it for a year to get the long-term capital gain. So he could do it next year, but he'd have to sell it, like, he has to wait another year before he sells the next
tranche. If I'm in the 12% tax bracket, there is no capital gain, short-term or long-term.
Yeah, well, true, but it's kind of a moot point, assuming he sells it and gets to the top of the bracket. Yeah.
No, I'm with you. What he's saying, I guess, he's utilizing that top bracket, and so next tax year, he's going to do it again.
Yeah, yeah. But I will correct you on one thing. Short-term capital gains are still taxed at ordinary income rates, not long-term cap. So it has to be long-term capital gain. That's why it has to wait 365 days.
Hey, what's this Spotify thing?
So somebody has been commenting on some of our episodes on Spotify. On March 12th, somebody said that there's no ACA tax subsidy cliff through 2025. It's a slope. And by the way, this person's username is 12124829700.
You know, Andy, I looked at that comment, and we did talk about the ACA tax subsidy, and that's how it used to be. It used to be if you were over 400% the poverty level, there was a cliff where you didn't get any subsidy at all. And this caller is right. Well, I think we said that wrong. That through 2025, it's not a cliff, it's a slope, meaning that if you're over 400% of the poverty line, it's not that you get nothing, you just get less and less and less subsidy. And that's through 2025. So that's a correct statement. We stand corrected.
So then for episode 475, the very first email, they said the first couple retiring with fixed income, almost covering their expenses, can retire. You guys are off your strategy game.
Wow.
And this is the one where, Joe, you were saying, you know, you can't rely on a 6% growth rate.
I disagree
with assumptions.
1212C3PO. Okay, so we usually do this off the cuff, but I wanted to explain that I'm definitely not off my strategy game here.
Okay, let's see.
There's a step period. So this Duke and Daisy, they're going to have some cash. But the problem is that their fixed income sources come. They want to retire at like 63 and 65. But then, or is that right? 63, 65?
Yeah.
They want to retire at 63 and 65.
That's three years from now.
He's not going to take his fixed income until age 70. So there's a five-year step period. She's got a little bit of a pension at age 66. And then, but she doesn't want to claim her benefit until age 67. So from her age 63 to 66 to 67 and to his age 70, is that there's all sorts of different distributions that need to come from the overall portfolio.
Right.
And so his argument, I guess, and comment, which is great. I love these comments. This is the only tweet that we've ever got, and I'm all fired up on it.
Right.
Is that, hey, you're off your game. And I'm telling you, I don't think I am. Because just hear me out. Her age 63 to his age 70. He wants to retire at 65. She wants to retire at 63. They're going to save for the next 3 years. They have $900,000 today. Let's assume with their savings in I'll use your 6% and assume they got $1 million once they retire.
Yeah, probably 1.2.
Okay. So year one in retirement, they need to pull $100,000 because that's what they want to live off of.
Right.
Year two, they need to pull $100,000. Year three, there's going to be $12,000 of fixed income. Assume that $100,000 doesn't have an inflation rate on it. They're going to have to pull $90,000.
Right.
So 3 years into retirement, they're pulling $300,000 a year.
Okay, I'll take that.
And then from the next 3 years, she's going to have her Social Security, right, and her pension. And now it's the step period till his age 70. So they're going to have to pull $40,000 per year, just living expenses, mind you, for the next 3 years until his fixed income comes into play.
And assuming 1.2 minus 300,000, the 40,000 divided into 800 or 900,000 is close enough to 4%.
So if I'm adding all of this up, that's one, that's 200, that's 300, that's $400,000 over the next couple of years.
Right.
That they'll pull from the overall portfolio. Okay. I'm not including inflation and I'm not including taxes on the distribution. So here's where I inflated their expenses out. So his age 70 is where they'll have all of their fixed income, her Social Security, the pension, and his Social Security.
Close to $100,000.
$100,000. But if you take $100,000 of living expenses today and inflate that with 3%, 3.5% inflation to his age 70, they're going to need $140,000.
Right.
So 100 minus 140 or 140 minus 100, they're going to be short 40 grand. So by the time he's age 70, they still need roughly $1 million to produce the $40,000 of additional income, not including taxes or not including any other inflation. My point was that sequence of return risk could blow these people up. If you run a straight line 6% rate of return, Mr. Spotify 12756543211, I totally agree. And I would agree with Al. But the problem is that I think people get overconfident when you have a run in the market. It's like, oh, the last couple of years, it's been great. They forget about 2022. They forget about all these down years. And so the problem, if they don't have a distribution strategy and the market goes down and now their $1 million goes to $700,000 and they're pulling $100,000 out over the next couple of years to live off of, it could blow Duke and Daisy right out of the Dukes of Hazzard.
It could. And then plus they're talking about, of course, they have to buy health insurance for Daisy for a couple of years, right? So that adds a little bit more. So when we do run some of these analysis, it's basically all we have is a straight line, right? I mean, we're just doing this off the cuff, right? It's just spitballing, but it's certainly reality is completely different, right? And just as you said, Joe, let's say you have two or three down years in the market when you're already kind of on the edge. This blows the entire thing up and you're back to work. So when we say
Your living expenses are going to have to be reduced.
Right, right.
Or you're just going to have to live off of your fixed income, and that's fine, right? If you blow through your cash in investments and then you have enough fixed income that you're comfortable with, then yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of times we'll say, yeah, it looks pretty good, but if it were me, I'd probably work another 2 or 3 years just for cushion, right. just because of these potential pitfalls.
Okay.
Nicely done, Joe.
Thank you. I had to do a little preparation here.
That's very good.
All right. That's it. Wonderful time. We'll see you next week. Joe's got your money well.
Muscat Wine, Zambonis, Spellbound, Roadhouse, and Joe the Dancer in the derails at the end of the episode, so stick around. Your Money, Your Wealth is your podcast, and this show wouldn't be a show without you. Tell your friends about YMYW and leave your honest reviews and ratings for Your Money, Your Wealth in Apple Podcasts and all the other podcast apps that allow them, like Spotify. Joe's clearly up to the challenge. If you haven't met with one of the experienced professionals on Joe and Big Al's team at Pure Financial Advisors, what are you waiting for? It's a free deep dive with the goal of optimizing your entire financial life. Pure Financial is a fee-only financial planning firm. Pure is also a fiduciary. That's why Pure's tagline is trustworthy by design. Click the free financial assessment banner in the podcast show notes at yourmoneyyourwealth.com or call 888-994-6257 and book your financial assessment. Whether you meet in person or online via Zoom, the Pure team will work with you to create a detailed plan, especially specially tailored for your needs and goals in retirement. Pure Financial Advisors is a registered investment advisor. This show does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors are advised not to rely on any information contained in the broadcast in the process of making a full and informed investment decision.
Musket. Can I get a glass of musket? I don't think I've ever heard of musket.
I don't either.
I think it's sweet like a port.
Sounds good. Musket.
I dare you, next time you go to a bar, I'll pop a musket.
What kind of musket?
Oh, you mean a muscat? No, I want a musket.
Moscow mule? No, musket.
How many Zambonis do you think there are in Phoenix, Arizona?
Not many.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, not too many.
In San Diego.
Not so many either. There's one for the Gulls.
Yeah.
There's one at UTC, I think, for
probably
ice skaters. Yeah, that's about it as far as I know.
Yeah.
Not a common vehicle.
I guess that's what Wayne does for a living.
Yeah. Have you ever been on a Zamboni?
No, I have seen them, but I've never been on one.
Yeah, I have.
You have?
Oh, yeah.
Why?
Oh, well, he's from Minnesota. Why not?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
They're everywhere.
My best friend from high school's father ran the ice arena.
Yeah. Did you drive it to and from work?
No.
Because there's ice on the streets?
No. Just down to the indoor ice arena.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yes. Andy, what's your movie story?
Some of my dearest friends, they're in their 60s and 70s. They actually have a 6-seat movie theater in their living room, and they run classic movies, like 16-millimeter films on a film projector that they've set up in their kitchen.
Oh,
and
sweet.
We went over, and they showed Spellbound, the 1945 Alfred Hitchcock movie.
Ooh.
And it's got like Salvador Dali artwork in this really surrealistic scene in it. And it's Ingrid Bergman and Gregory Peck. They're a couple of psychoanalysts. And
Gregory
it's
Peck.
All about, yeah.
And it's like To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes. But this movie's got amnesia and love and murder and all sorts of crazy stuff in it. So it was awesome. We got to see this in their house.
It's no The Irish Wish.
Fortunately, I haven't seen a movie since then.
So did they put the theater down, or do they keep the theater going?
The screen with the curtain and all of that is always there. He sets up the projector specifically for movie nights. And
from the kitchen.
From the kitchen.
Yeah, it goes all the way through the family room and into the living room.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's got the 16. He's got a film vault. He used to work at a local TV station, and when they switched over all this stuff away from film, he was able to acquire a bunch of it. And so you just walk into the vault, and he's got all these classic movies. It's very cool.
I like that.
And then,
that.
Of course, you have to have an intermission because he has to take the reel off and put the next one on. And his wife makes popcorn for us. It was awesome. It was a great time. So there you go. I got to see Spellbound from 1945, Alfred Hitchcock.
Sounds super fun.
It was. It was a great time.
Yep. I'd probably pass on that one.
I'm not surprised. It's not Tokyo Vice.
Tokyo Vice. So good. So good. I did watch Roadhouse, which was absolutely awful.
That's because it was unrewatchable, isn't it?
Well, I loved the original Roadhouse. So I did a little double feature the other night.
Right.
I think it was Friday night. So I was like, okay, I'm going to watch this remake of the Roadhouse with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Okay.
I mean, it was so bad, it was actually okay. It was tolerable. There were some parts I enjoyed. And like Jake Gyllenhaal is ripped. It's like, I don't know what that guy's on, but he's ripped. So there you go, Andy. You can watch Jake Gyllenhaal beat some people up. So after that, I was like, I'm going to watch the original Roadhouse.
I have to go for Gregory Peck.
Okay.
Patrick Swayze.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, this is the best movie.
Oh, you liked it?
Oh, I've seen it a million times.
Yeah.
It was like part of my youth. There's so many influences. Part of my youth.
Right.
It's like I had a Jeep Wrangler in college.
Got it. So you're identifying.
I can. They're like Otis Redding songs.
That's why you've been stuck on Patrick Swayze the last couple of weeks.
I love Patrick Swayze. He's my guy.
Your guy, yeah.
Yeah. R.I.P. P.
Yeah, R.I.P. Correct. Yep.
And you kind of dance like him a little bit. So.
No, I'm a really good dancer, Andy.
You are. Absolutely. I agree.
But I did roll my foot at our little company party.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
You didn't do much dancing, but you kind of
started
it.
Yeah, because I rolled my foot.
Is that because Kyle Stacey actually...
Yes.
Like, challenged you, and so you ended
then
up.
Then he stepped on me.
He did.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
So yeah, then
Oh, wow.
I
Have you recovered? Or yeah. You still hurt?
No, I'm good.
Yeah, good. Okay.